On the programme, new, now, next, voices in Irish and world architecture and Weaving the Sky, the work of a unique Polish artist on show in Ireland. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. First to architecture and this year's events in the new, now, next series organised by the Irish Architecture Foundation in conjunction with ARIP, the celebrated international firm of designers, planners and engineers. This series of talks by globally significant architects also provides a platform for a new generation of young Irish architects to discuss their work and vision and aims to increase public awareness of architecture and built design in Ireland. Later in the programme, we'll hear briefly from Finnish architect Samuli Woolston, who was in Dublin last week as the first speaker in this year's New Now Next series. But before that, with me in studio to consider what's new, what's now and what's next in Irish and international architecture are Natalie Wadick, director of the Irish Architecture Foundation, Rory McGowan, a director of ARIP, and Andrew Griffin of Urban Agency, one of the younger generation of young architects who are given a platform through the New Now Next series. Natalie Wadick, this series of talks running for the last few years, and like the Open House project where people can visit public buildings, drawing quite an audience.
It has been drawing quite an audience, and I mean, a lot of that is to do with, say, the work of the Irish Architecture Foundation, like Open House. For instance, if we'd done You Now Next, 9 years ago, Open House is now 9 years old this year, before we started Open House and before the IF was in existence, we probably wouldn't have such a mixed audience. We probably would be talking, architects would be talking to architects, which wouldn't actually then sort of share the wonderful creative ideas outside and develop that design culture, which I spoke of. So with mechanisms like Open House, which remarkably last year we had something like 27,000 visits over 2 days, we reach a broad net of people and we bring them into our other programmes like New Now Next. So what we find with, say, last year we started doing New Now Next and we measure our audience, that we do have a significant mix in the audience. Yes, of course, there are architects in the audience, but there are people from generally all aspects of creative industry and the general public who are interested in finding out more about architecture and actually what architects do.
We'll be talking to the Finnish architect Samuli Woolston a little later. Tell me about him and some of the other international architects who'll speak later in the year and why you choose the particular people you do as part of this programme.
We have four events this year, and three of them are international, and then we have one event which is three Irish Practice, the New Generation, which is crucially important. And we choose them because they are dynamic in their field, and they are achieving great things globally in their own countries and globally, and they are making a mark on the general international architecture scene. And we want to invite them to Dublin, and we want them to present to our audience. Samuli is really, really interesting because he has a very sort of interdisciplinary approach to the work he does, and it's important that people realise that the aspects that go into creating buildings, it's a process, and it's about collaboration, it's about working with different people. Other speakers like Min Suk Cho from Korea is coming in September. He's also the commissioner of the Korean Pavilion in the Architecture Biennale this year. And he's particularly influential in talking about urban design. And lastly, we have Ole Sheeran, who is a big name in the architecture scene. He was formerly partner with Rem Koolhaas and OMA, and that should be a big draw because of his very, very, very high and significant profile. He is based in China. He's worked on major, major projects.
Rory McGowan of ARIP, you know, with the Irish Architecture Foundation, co-host these series of talks. I think many people listening may not know exactly the work that ARIP does, though they may have heard us reference it in discussing the extraordinary work and legacy, for instance, of the Irish engineer Peter Rice or the work of Michael Scott. Set up in 1946, and the blurb says ARIP shapes a better world. Remind us briefly what ARIP does and makes possible, and I suppose the truly international nature of its work.
Well, ARIP was started in 1946 by Ove ARIP, and it was with a post-war generation of architects and engineers living in London. And he decided that it was about time to break down the traditional roles between of separation between architect and engineer and try and generate something new. So from the outset, he wanted a more multidisciplinary approach, a collaboration approach to achieving the built environment. He went on to set up the firm. It became popular, became well known as a place for, you know, mavericks and brilliant engineers to go and do something different, including Peter Rice, who joined, and the firm became, you know, a household name really because of the Sydney Opera House, which Peter was involved in, and Ove and other partners. When Ove came up for retirement in his in the late 60s, 70s, he was asked by the other partners to basically write a constitution for the firm, and that's the key speech we have. It's very detailed, and in that he set out a vision for a company. And I think key to that is the ownership structure. We're a cooperative. We've no shareholders, we have no partners, and we owe no one any debt. Even though we've grown to a company of 11,000 plus people around the world with a turnover of over a billion euro, we are still completely a cash-based company. So that independence and the fact that we own the firm, it's a naked-in, naked-out firm, so no one from the
bit like life.
Secretary, yes, bit like life, to the chairman, own the firm or can buy or sell it.
And of course, again, a significant presence here in Ireland.
Yes. So in when the firm started in 1946, one of the first projects was the Central Bus Station. So, and Michael Scott invited Ove to come over to Dublin, which he did, to look at this project. And the project office opened in Dublin, and he returned to London to open the office there. So that's the history of the firm. The firm has currently about 380 people working for it, and we are involved in all aspects of engineering in the Irish scene, but also more and more internationally across Europe and Africa, North America, and even Asia.
I suppose there's a certain perception that Ireland is still pretty backwards when it comes to architecture and design in general. I suppose the rash of awful building during the so-called boom years didn't help. We're coming out of recession, but are things improving, do you think, from your perspective, when it comes to architecture and design and our built environment? In general, are they improving?
Well, I think I need to zoom out a bit and tell you a little bit about my own career. Well, I've worked internationally since I was a graduate, joining IRIP in Dublin, and spent 23 years working abroad, and just came back 3.5 years ago. And one of the lessons I brought back from my travels, but particularly working for 8 years in Asia and living in Beijing, was that for Europe to survive at these ever-increasing blocks in the world, including Asia, that the only way Europe is going to survive is by adding value, multidisciplinary, well-managed, ingenious design, creativity in all fields. So from product design, furniture, through the arts, through architecture, a whole range. That is the only way Europe is going to survive. And I came back with that very much planted in my mind. And I think that's relevant to Ireland as well. Ireland needs to broaden its industry, you know, its economic base. It's clear where its focuses are, where investment and genuine opportunities are needed are in creativity.
Is enough being done? I mean, you've already, for instance, talking about design as a possible subject in secondary school. Initiatives like that must help to pave the way towards change and a better appreciation and application of design.
Yes, there's a lot being done. What I will tell you is that the energy that exists in Ireland among young people to get involved in creative industries is incredible. However, on the other hand, when I travel around the world to, you know, whether, you know, away from the well-known centres for Irish people of London, New York and Australia, for example, the streets of Seoul, Beijing, Tokyo, you know, they're teeming with Spaniards, Italians, Americans, you will struggle to find Irish architects and designers out there. So I would say one of the big issues here in Ireland generally is a certain degree of parochialism. And it's this idea that while, you know, Ireland, to maintain its standard of living, the vision it has for the future as part of a global market, also thinks that it has the right to stay at home and not prepare people to engage with that global market is wrong. And business people will tell you that, and lots of people will tell you that. And that's what has to be broken, as well as investment in education.
Andrew Griffin, you are one of the young people who did leave. You know, you studied in Copenhagen, I think, for 7 years. And, of course, Scandinavia has a long history of design culture and a very particular aesthetic in architecture and building. Is a country like Denmark still way ahead of Ireland when it comes to real appreciation of and support for the best of architecture and design?
Well, Denmark had a great... Scandinavia had a great period in the 1960s and 1970s when furniture design was key, when, you know, Aalto was doing his great work and so on. But it dissipated in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and not that much was happening. And what happened was the government invested, and they said, actually, design can lead to money for the exchequer. Actually, we can make export culture. They do it with pharmaceuticals, they do it with IT, and they're going to do it with design. So I say it ad nauseum, but what I think that Denmark is a great brand for design, but the culture of design is as good as Ireland. I mean, what's different here is there's much more collaboration, there's much more... people know each other, people work with each other a lot more. A lot of designers are my clients. We work with them on other projects. So that scene is actually very prevalent here, whereas in Denmark it's more of a big brand, and it's wrapped in a lot of money. And that's the major difference I see. After 7 years there and being back here for one now, I just see there's a lot more money invested and a lot more support for architects like us to actually, as Rory's saying, get out and go abroad and do interesting work.
Would you agree with him that maybe not enough young Irish architects are getting out there, going abroad and going outside of the major and almost predictable centres, you know, to places like Beijing and looking to a broader world?
Yeah, I mean, I teach down in UL and in the fifth year programme, and the most of our students are going to London, and because it's easy, you know, they go to London and they leave with a very optimistic, aspirational view of what they can do and what they can achieve. And I think it's when they don't travel far enough, and they probably don't travel wide enough to see cultures which are vastly expanding. I mean, Europe is tinkering with what we've already done in the 15th and 16th century, but where places are really developing and where as an architect you can have major impact is places like China, places like Africa, places that are really evolving and developing. And that's where we have to actually position ourselves to work. I mean, China has a third of the world's population, and it's expanding more than any place in the world. So I also worked there for 3 years, and the reason I did was not because there was a lot of work, it was because you have the ability to have an impact on that society, and architecture can play a very positive role or a very negative role in a society, and young people have to get up and not just go and design a nice little coffee shop in London, but design major cities in China, major cities in Africa that can actually have a real impact on the world.
And it's a strange time in Ireland in a way, because there has been less money for capital infrastructure, for investment in the last 6-7 years. And then when you do see a striking new building, for instance, like the new library in Dunleary being built, it seems almost inevitable that there's something of a public and political backlash against, you know, against the design. So it's a challenge all the time, isn't it, to make innovative new public buildings here?
Yeah, well, the government simply aren't building very much at all. You know, I'm just going to be pretty blunt about that. When I look at a country like Denmark, has the same population roughly as Ireland, same size footprint, same amount of architects. There's 10 times as much public work. And it's a problem. We need to be building more public buildings, and we need to be doing more good public buildings. And we should stop doing the quick fix and start actually investing in our country, in our culture. And the government, I think, have a very short-sighted argument. It's going to cost us 50 million to build that building. What they're not seeing is the 500 million they get back in the long term through, you know, if you invest in a park, it might cost you 5 million to develop a park or a waterfront, But actually the health benefits, the lowering the obesity rate, lowering heart disease, they have huge impacts on our society. So we need to be, you know, we need to think more long term and stop thinking 4-year political terms about buildings.
You're involved in designing a space for the Dublin Fringe. Tell me about that.
Well, the Fringe Festival is it's an amazing international festival. They're world renowned theatre festival dealing with the sort of fringe of theatre. And Ireland's always been very famous for theatre, so people flock here to see it. And the Fringe asked us through with Natalie and with Rory to look at a new home for them. They've always sort of had temporary homes, the Spiegel Tent and the Docks, and they wanted to have something which was Irish designed, which was Irish materials, and which was which could serve as a platform for them to grow as a festival. So so we're working on that at the moment.
And what kind of shape do you think it's likely to take?
Well, the project is actually quite simple. It's quite a fun project because it has it's not really a permanent building. It has to be built and in a day, in 24 hours exactly, and it lasts for 30 days and it has to be taken down in a day. So that was the kind of most interesting parameter. So it was actually, we worked with Rory on it, and some of his development work in Africa sort of led to the generation of the design, this kind of barn building way of doing it. But I think the key thing about that project is it's actually it'll have a huge impact, and it'll be very cheap in comparison to other things that we're spending money on.
And will it have one location, or can it move?
It can move. So it can move to wherever Fringe want to put it that in one particular year. But it's designed for North Docks, which is Spencer Dock, which is the tightest side it could be on. But it could be in Marion Square. It could be in St. Stephen's Green. It could be anywhere it wants to be.
You'd also like, I think, to design a new housing estate. And clearly with a growing demand for new housing, especially in Dublin, that might just come to pass. What would be new or different or particular about the housing estate that you would build?
Well, I suppose I'll back up a bit on that comment. I think that good design should not be exclusive. It shouldn't be for people who are rich. It should be for everybody. And good design is when it's good, you don't notice it. When you pick up a coffee cup and it's comfortable, you don't really realize it's well designed. It's been thought out. The problem with Irish houses is that they are a post-war phenomenon. They were built extremely quickly to deal with our housing crisis in the 1950s, and were built as small as possible. They weren't really, the conditions of the house weren't really looked at. The light, the orientation, the view, the wind, the size of spaces, the type of spaces. But yet Irish people become very accustomed to them. So actually, the thing is actually what, you know, we built so many houses during the boom here of such poor quality that were never rethought. So I think actually if you could design a 500 house housing estate in Cavan, you could actually probably have more impact in this country if you did it in an interesting way, as cheap as they've been built in the past. You would actually give an extraordinary quality to people's lives. We, you know, we spend more time in our buildings than we do in anything else. We're born in them, we die in them, and we spend our entire lives in them. So they should be of a high quality. So I think that actually, rather than focusing on the key kind of public buildings where a lot of contemporary architects focus, we should actually in Ireland particularly focus on the areas where we're going to build a lot of stuff. We're going to build a lot of houses. We're going to build a lot of office buildings. We're going to build a lot of apartments. And that's where I think you could actually have real innovation that will matter to people's lives, the average person.
Rory, do you think it is possible to achieve good design and architecture for the majority of people and for public space? You know, is that down to money or to vision and education at least as much?
I think it is down to vision and education. One of the lessons I learned very early on in my career was on a project in France, and it's still the lowest budget project I ever worked on, but it's one of the most famous buildings by Rem Koolhaas in the World Congress Expo in Lille in France. And I learned there, it's not about money, it's about design, and it's about using what you've got to create something different. And I think, in Ireland, it's about building communities, and it's about building places people want to live. It's about the more holistic view on what we actually want as a society. And, you know, for example, I know Andrew's thinking in these estates or whatever, that it's providing houses that are suitable for people at different stages in life as well, that they, you know, generate communities that are properly serviced, that look at the landscape, you know, the outdoor space, the connectivity to cities, transport. It's the much broader view on these projects will make them successful. And that quite often doesn't cost money. It's actually cutting out money. So, no, it's not about money.
It's more, at least as much about education. And Will, Natalie, you were saying, and you've said it before, you know, that you think there is something of a momentum here at the moment in terms of public appreciation of, especially of architecture and its importance. But in the last 6-7 years, we've seen many architecture practices close, many young architects forced to leave the country, or indeed forced to look to other sources of work. How do we find the balance between public interest, even enthusiasm for architecture, and then practical support for best practice and innovation in a new generation?
I agree with everything that's been said here. It is about changing a mindset in order to feed the needs of our young generation of innovators and designers, as well as the needs of our public. And it's yes, through education, and it's through awareness, and it's through mechanisms like our organisation, like the IIF. You spoke about Rory Quinn, and you spoke about schools. We deliver a National Architects and Schools Scheme, which could do with a lot more investment, but it's a start. And we can't meet the demands of teachers who want architects to come into schools and talk to and do proper action-based learning, not just to come in and leave and just do a quick talk, but actually to do projects. This all helps with sort of the generational mindset. There are other initiatives that are happening, and again, the government has designated 2015 the year of design. I mean, that's kind of phenomenal. It's huge. And that's specifically to tackle the need to create the industry and to create jobs. And all of these things are really, really important. And that's why I do think we're turning a corner in terms of our appreciation of design, in terms of how we define ourselves as a nation, as a culture, who is growing and increasingly more interested in design. It is happening. We see it. We encounter it ourselves every time we do a project in the Irish Architecture Foundation. It is developing, and this can only help the profession. It can only help the industry, and it can only help how we're perceived outside of Ireland.
Andrew, how important do you think it is that young architects who have studied here go abroad, not necessarily to study, but to work and to see what's happening in the wider world, and not even necessarily to bring it back to Ireland, but to get out there and work?
It's the most important thing. When you study architecture, you go away every year on a study trip, and it's fundamental. It forms you. You go and see work by other architects and so on. And you take a year out and you go and work. So I actually worked under Ole Sheeran, who'll be here in OMA, for a year when I was in third year in college. And it was the most formative experience I think I will have. I probably learned more there than I learned in 5 years in university. So, and then you get the bug, you realise that there's an island mentality here. And there's, when you're in Germany, it's no problem to get on a train and go to Switzerland, or get on a train to go to France. And that mentality means that Germans don't mind going to China or going to Africa and working on projects there. And I think Irish people need to get that into their blood, that we need to get that kind of bug of travel and that bug of working on interesting projects. And if I could have any recommendation to students of architecture, you know, use the crisis, use the fact that there's not a lot of work here as an advantage, and go to places where there are work, because they're normally some of the most interesting places. Like, for instance, China is now booming and there's loads of jobs. Young graduates should be going there and should really be working on very exciting large-scale projects and seeing cultures which aren't similar to theirs but are vastly different. And it's, you know, apart from the work itself, the working on the projects day to day, the ability to travel and to travel while you're working, get paid for it by a company to do it, is, you know, it's unbelievable. A lot of other generations would never have had this opportunity. My parents certainly wouldn't. My grandparents certainly wouldn't. So for young graduates to be very achievable to get on a plane and go to China or Nigeria or wherever is something they should take advantage of.
Andrew Griffin, Roy McGowan and Natalie Wadick, thanks to you all. Now, the first speaker in the new Now Next series was Finnish architect Samuli Wollsten. I've been speaking to him about his work and he told me how the concept of beauty has been re-established as a basic concept in Finnish architecture.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was a word denied for us when we studied, that we weren't allowed to kind of design things to be beautiful. You had to have other requirements, like the program or the location or something would do something, but not just the fact that it would be beautiful. That just wasn't something that was okay. But now at the office, especially us four partners, we talk about beauty a lot. And it's a very important thing for us, especially in designing public buildings, to be attractive.
Often when we think of Scandinavian design, we think of minimalism, a certain minimalism, clean lines, wood and glass. And I wonder, is that almost something of a cliche in terms of our perception? But insofar as it is true, is it also true for Finland as much as we'd say Denmark and Norway?
I think design-wise they are quite close, but I would say that there is a softness to it in relation to a lot of the design, say in Southern Europe or somewhere like that. There's a lot of wood, curved shapes, things like that, and that still is very much so and present.
Is there an influence at all from traditional, from vernacular architecture?
Perhaps through the material wood, there is some, but it's not very obvious. It's not. I wouldn't say it's a strong tendency to take traditional elements into design.
Your own work with your company, Anna Architects, and I've looked at some of the images online. They're very striking, especially this design for the Central Library in Helsinki. Describe that for me, and I'll give the website. People can look at this image themselves. Listeners can look at it later. But it's a very striking, quite spare. But I must say again, rather beautiful building.
Yeah, well, I mean, to just try and describe what it looks like, if you like. It's a very hard place. A lot of glass and steel and materials like that around it, asphalt. So we decided to use wood, and it's basically almost like three different spaces stacked on top of each other. And the mid-volume would be carved out of wood. And that contains everything that needs to be in a separate room, hermetic, you know, sound or light or whatever. Underneath it is a completely open sort of vault-like shape under the wooden cavity, if you like, which is more of part of the street where you'd meet people, where events would take place. And then on top of the wooden mass is the more traditional sort of quiet, open library space with the books and the shelves and a sort of cloud-like roof on top.
What kind of response have you got to the building?
A very good one. We've been extremely happy with what we've read in the newspapers. And I mean, often when you're spending 100 million euros on a public building, usually someone's complaining about, you know, for instance, they're going to build a children's hospital in Helsinki, so obviously that's a kind of obvious project to put the money into. But there hasn't been much of that in this case, and we've been quite happily surprised. But I mean, it's also the most liked, most used public service in Finland is the library.
And I think the location of the library is very particular and has a particular resonance, again, within Finnish culture.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a sort of gathering of important buildings. I mean, the main railway station, the Parliament building, the National Contemporary Museum of Art, a music hall, Finlandia Hall, which was... Alvar Aalto's one of his main pieces. They're all immediately next to this building.
Finnish architect Samuli Wollsten there, and that new central library in Helsinki will be finished in 2018. To see images of that and other buildings by Samuli Wollsten, go to ALA.fi, that's ALA.fi. A new generation, a panel of three young Irish architects, a discussion with them, Lawrence Lord, Lucy Jones and Steve Larkin, will be held on June the 26th. Full details of that and other events in the new Now Next series, which runs until the autumn, at architecturefoundation.ie. In a moment, a textile artist who shapes extraordinary images of the natural world in the high-rise architecture of Warsaw.
Simple things to make you smile this week at Centra. Like Centra Fresh Irish Pork Loin Roast Art Chops, half price. Centra Carrot, Cauliflower and Broccoli Tray, only €1. Centra Easy Peeler Net, only €1. And Squeeze Orange Juice, 1 litre, only €1. See in store for details. Centra, brighten up your day.
Come to this year's Dalkey Book Festival from June 19th to the 22nd. See Salman Rushdie, Amos Oz, Sebastian Barry, John Banville and Joseph O'Connor. Or if politics is your thing, what about Robert Fisk, Max Kaiser and Olivia O'Leary? Or comedy with Apres Match, Eleanor Tiernan and David O'Doherty? The Dalkey Book Festival, global names in a local setting. Tickets on sale now at dalkeybookfestival.org.
In association with RTE Radio 1.
You're listening to Arts Tonight, and next to the Dock Arts Centre in Carrick and Shannon, County Leitrim, where a remarkable exhibition of tapestries by Polish artist Barbara Falkowska is currently on show. Weaving the Sky is a retrospective exhibition showing work made over a period of more than 50 years. Work striking for its consistency and diversity. Textile art that seems at times closer to painting than to the weft and weave of tapestry. Falkowska is now 84 and lives in a high-rise apartment building in Warsaw. Her work has been shown at MoMA in New York and in London, Canada and throughout Scandinavia. Weaving the Sky is her first exhibition in Ireland. We've been to the Dock to see her work. And curator Alice Lyons told me how she first met Barbara Falkowska.
I met her in 1984 on the coast of Maine at a place called Haystack Mountain School of Crafts. Barbara was teaching a workshop for 3 weeks on textiles and weaving, and I was a student. And I was thoroughly impressed with her as an artist and as a person. And that began a connection and a friendship that's lasted 30 years with Barbara and with her family, her niece, Basha, who travels with Barbara as an interpreter, also became my friend. And so the show grows out of admiration for her work and out of friendship.
And the exhibition here then really spans a great deal of her working life, doesn't it? So you can trace something of a line from her early work and then the development and change over the decades.
Yeah, there are pieces here right behind us that are from her school years in the late 50s, early 60s. And there's a piece here that she did this year.
And how would you describe that change? I mean, you mentioned where she's studied, and I presume that her work as well comes out of a strong tradition of fabric, of textile, and traditional textile making in the East and in Poland.
That's right, yeah. And the pieces you see behind here are what are called double weavings, and they're very similar to kilim carpet making. And so that's the tradition that she comes out of, which is also something very alive in the east of Poland. And so you see that more traditional, very horizontal weft and warp. And then as she grows and changes as an artist, things get more idiosyncratic. The width of the wool that she uses gets wider in some places, and the weaving gets much more off-grid.
What materials does she use, and how? Where does she get her materials? I know that I think that there's one very particular source, an unusual source of wool.
Yeah, most of her work is made from wool and linen, but there's also flax, sisal. There are also all the wool is dyed with natural dyes, and some of the things she uses to dye are alder and oak bark, madder, indigo, onion skins to make yellow. And the wool comes, much of it over her career came from a friend of hers who moved to the only remaining primeval forest in Europe, in the east of Poland. He has a home there where he raises bees and sheep, and he would send her wool from that herd.
So very much from nature. And it's interesting because in her work is both reflecting nature and deliberately doing so, I think, within an urban environment. I mean, she makes all her work in Warsaw, but it's reflecting this wider natural world. And does that go back in some way to her own experience as a child and her family history?
Yes, it does. Barbara was born into the countryside, into a family of Polish nobility, a landowning family, what the Poles call the Szlachta, the nobility. And she was born near Grodno in what's now Belarus. When she was a young girl, probably aged 8 or 9, the family home was destroyed by the invading Soviets and the family was split up. This was during a time period when the Polish intelligentsia, anyone really was in the educated classes of Poland, was being hunted down either on one side by the Soviets or on the other by the Nazis. And they had to split up the family, and the children were in hiding. And at some points, they were in forests, hidden, split from their parents, and occasionally having prearranged secret meetings with parents by a river, as I'm told. So there is a dark part of Barbara's story that has to do with nature and the forest as well.
So in a way, the celebration of nature is probably also, without reading too much into it, a certain marker of her own experience and the closeness of nature that can also mean a kind of freedom.
Mm-hmm. I think so. And I think we could say that the work stubbornly aligns itself with the natural world. And I think Barbara, through the course of her life, has committed herself to bringing that world and to bringing nature and natural materials into this concrete urban space that she finds herself living in.
We were talking about architecture earlier in the program, and I know that she lives in this apartment block in Warsaw, which I think is pretty much kind of, is it Stalinist style era, or is it earlier than that?
Where she lives now is quite modern, quite contemporary. But when I first visited her in 1990, it was a Stalin era, a concrete building, yes. As is much of Warsaw. And the contrast, even looking up at her balcony when I first visited, I think she was on the 10th floor, and I looked up, and amid these rows of concrete, solid poured concrete balconies, was one balcony that had a grape arbor and these trailing green plants growing off of it. And I later learned, of course, that that was hers.
Is there a sense in which her work is quietly subversive in its looking at nature and the natural world within this unremittingly urban environment? And not necessarily political, but I suppose political insofar as questions of the environment can be deeply political now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think so. And I think I had that sense early on, and I think over time that's only strengthened. That, as I said earlier, it's this sense that she is aligning herself with something other than the current political situation, and that in this kind of quiet stubbornness there is something subversive. And there's an ethic in the aesthetic, if you know what I mean.
Is there, I mean, looking at the work earlier, and we'll go and look at some of it shortly, but it struck me that there is somehow a deep sense of a spiritual celebration within it. I mean, quietly, but it seems very, very strong in reflecting nature, that there's also a reflection of something bigger than nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She talks about, I do think that there is that sense, hard to articulate really, but she does talk about her work, wanting her work to be reflective of both the beauty, the terror, and the mystery within nature. And I think that can only be seen as a spiritual kind of connection to nature, yeah.
Shall we go and look at some of the beauty and terror and nature and all of it?
Yeah.
I suppose this piece here at the top of the stairs in the dock is the image that is used for the exhibition and Weaving the Sky, and her use of colour again is in this piece, in many pieces, but it's very strong in this.
Yeah, it is. This one is called The Park, and it's mostly weeds, as she says, and it has a colour scheme that goes from a real dark range at the bottom of browns and beetroot colours, all different kinds of warm browns and cool black browns, lavender kinds of colours, but all with this very dark range. But the warp of the piece is made from a yellow ochre wool that keeps popping up every once in a while. If there's a really thick piece of brown, you see these little flecks of yellow ochre. And then as you travel up, and of course we're going in a world that looks like it's underground, and then we're traveling up into a world of light, and then you see these pieces of lighter colored, lighter hued wools come in. So there's ivory colored wools and sky blue pieces of wool, little flecks of rougher straw-like yellow ochre, and then flecks of really bright raspberry colored and orange colored wools. And so you're making this journey up from the ground into the sky. And in fact, Barbara says, and this is where the title for the show comes, is she says that whenever she started a piece, she always wished that she could make a weaving about the sky, but it often turned into something else, usually something kind of earthbound, gnarly, stones, plants, those kinds of things. But you do see bits of the sky in this one.
Have you seen her work on her loom? Have you seen her make the work?
Yes, I have. She uses a fork, just an ordinary table fork, to pack the wool into the warp as she's placing it into the warp, which I think is very funny. And she uses an upright loom, so she sits at the warp. The warp is vertical, and she's putting the wool into it that way.
And in making a piece like this, which is rectangular, I mean, is it always a case of starting at the bottom mm-hmm. and working upwards?
I believe so. That's what I've seen her do, yeah. And then she has a crank and she just rolls it as she goes along on the bottom as the piece finishes. And she makes it in this little studio. It's a bedroom in a small apartment in Warsaw that's turned into her studio. And the studio is packed full of wool. That's, you know, there's just shelves and shelves. And it's also packed full of things like dried leaves, grasses, flowers. It's a beautiful, even smells beautiful, this room. And it looks out the window over blocks and blocks of apartment blocks, a very, very urbanized space that she's looking out.
This piece, Celery, is I think really, really, really quite exquisite. And again, I love her honesty in saying, you know, she called it celery. Then friends said, don't call it celery because that's too mundane. Call it September or something a little bit more abstract. And then she thought, no, actually it's celery and I'll call it celery. And of course it's quite magnificent.
Yeah, this one I think of is a little bit, there's something a little bit different to this piece from her others. This one to me looks more tied to decorative arts and there's something French about that tapestry. There's something very, very elegant about celery. And you don't see any stalks of celery in it. It seems to be all about the leaves, doesn't it? Or maybe even some
it's
sky.
It's light, isn't it? It's light and, light and leaf and growth. I mean, there's such a strong sense of growth and nature in it. Yeah. But again, you know, this use of, you know, the ends of the tapestries, each one is different. So it's like an artist using particular framing devices. I mean, she's constantly playing with materiality and what she can do.
Her fringes are never the same. Sometimes they're hanging down like horsetails, and other times they're big and clunky like these. These, you know, each piece of fringe here is 4 inches wide, and then very idiosyncratically colored. You know, there's all these brown ones, and then there's a little, you know, pink colored one there. And I think her sense of humor comes out in those fringes, actually.
There's a wonderful shimmer in it. I mean, you don't often think of tapestry shimmering, but in this there is.
There is almost
sort of light and water. What, it's about what? Is it 2 meters? 2 meters by
It's about two and a half meters, maybe, by one.
It's a large piece.
It is
one of
the
larger pieces here. And that's striking as well that she works on large scale and really, really small scale as well.
Yeah, there isn't any standard Falkowska size.
This these four pieces, I mean, there's certain sort of sense of connection and symmetry, but looking at what she says as well, where she says, you know, learning to be humble as an artisan, that craftsmanship eliminates bluff. Rare statement and a very striking one.
And I think that's something that's interesting about this work is it comes out of that sense of craft. And yet there's also something else that's happening with this work that isn't just executing a technique. And you can see this clearly in all of these. Falkowska doesn't draw a design beforehand. She's really drawing on the loom. So she's setting up some decisions she's making beforehand, the color of the warp, say, that she's stringing the loom with. And maybe in this group of work, there's this very restrained kind of Giorgio Morandi kind of palette of very, very milky, milky whites and pinks and shell colors and beiges and browns. But in the one up here, some flecks of blue. But it's quite a pulled back palette compared to the other pieces in the room. But then within that, there is this openness to drawing and to accident and to chance.
Couple of pieces I want to look at in the other gallery. One remarkable piece that you say is her envisioning almost of God creating the world.
It's called The Beginning.
We come into a dazzle of light in this room and in this gallery, but this piece in its wonderful darkness is dazzling too.
It is, and the scale of it as well. This is by far the largest piece in the show. It's about 2 meters by 2.5 meters high. And it's the contrast in color in this piece is just incredible. There are these rich chocolate browns with black and very deep ultramarine blue. And then there, contrasted with these beautiful sand and ochre colored light patches. And there's this wonderful sense of kind of churning energy of light and dark meeting each other and mingling in some places and other places really coming up and clashing. You know, so there's this wonderful sense of movement, and it's interesting. I've been watching lots of visitors come in and look at this piece and are always struck by it. And many, many people, before they even look at the title, have that sense that it's about creation or the beginning of something.
But it's like energy made manifest somehow.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary jolt within it.
There is. And what's amazing, I was saying earlier, is this has been folded up in a bench, you know, a kind of storage bench with a cushion on it in Barbara's apartment for quite some time. It hasn't been seen, you know. And it's just incredible to have it here.
That's a truly remarkable piece, a wonderful piece. And again, this same wonderful kind of fraying and pull here at the bottom, I suppose. Which of course would have been the beginning, probably originally.
Yeah, the fringe at the bottom is very strange. So parts of it are a foot wide, other parts of it are very thin. Some of it is really dark and almost like soil, like unturned soil, clay soil, and then with these flecks of flax or sisal. Kind of penetrating down into them. You do get this real subterranean sense, don't you, from
those
that one?
Little shots of red as well. Leap out. It's a wonderful piece, really wonderful piece. And then beside it, this
waterlogged meadow.
beautiful, isn't it? It's just absolutely beautiful, the colour and the evocation of nature and growths, flowers, is wonderful.
Yeah, that's a very Leitrim, you know, it could be the banks of the Shannon, that's called Waterlogged Meadow. And that piece is about 2 meters long, but very thin. It's only about 1 foot thin. And it's all about green, isn't it?
Mm.
Olive green and some more forest greens, and then these beautiful flecks of irises and of blue and yellow and red, and in some places the wool is really, really thick and kind of bursting out from the warp. Look at there, those big brown pieces on the top there that are, you know, as thick as my thumb, and they're barely being held in by the warp, and so there's this wonderful real material sense of the wool pushing the boundary of the warp in that piece. Yeah, that one is a very popular piece with our visitors. A lot of people have wanted to walk home with that one.
So there's been quite a response to the work.
It's been a wonderful response to the work, yeah, extraordinary. There have been many, many people who have been kind enough to want to take things home from this show. So that's been very, very impressive.
I think it's very interesting for people as well to consider, you know, textile art, and because we don't have so very much of it in Ireland, you know, post Kilkenny design, and that time, you think of somebody like Patrick Scott, you know, architect and extraordinary painter, and then the maker of these wonderful tapestries, which can still be seen in Carlo and Imma. But is there any equivalent figure, Irish figure, to Barbara now? Not that one needs such a figure, but it's an interesting contrast in a way.
Yeah, it's funny because these pieces have been remarked upon by painters very much as very equivalent to the kinds of things they do, and so they are inhabiting this funny space between painting and textile. It's funny, the person that sprung to mind when you mentioned that, to my mind, was Eileen Gray and her rugs. A very, very different kind of language and idiom, but also someone looking at that decorative language and doing something slightly different with it in textiles and with wool.
It's interesting as well to think of both Eileen Gray and Patrick Scott as architects. Mm-hmm. And this is somehow within this work, there's a really strong sense of an architectural mind as well.
Yes, very much. And also the way that these spaces have a dialogue with the architecture even of this building and of this room. They really, they hold space in a different way than any other kind of thing would. And I think it has to do with the whole material quality and the contrast, the softness of the wool, and the presence of the wool, even standing out from the wall. They have, I think, a beautiful dialogue with the architecture of the room.
It's very interesting because as well as, you know, some of the very figurative pieces, there's a really strong and celebratory sense of abstraction within the pieces.
Well, over here, she has this smaller piece. This is one of my favorite pieces in the show. It's called Black Tree. And she says something really, really strong about abstraction in relation to this piece. She says, "A black tree. The goal I had in mind was to prove with a specific example that when looking at a fragment of the whole, we see a so-called abstraction. There's everything in nature, also abstraction." And that piece is all about that. It's a tree, but it's also this kind of crazy, just wild improvisation on pattern and light and dark, and at times
and energy again.
Yeah, and energy, and at times the shapes of the leaves have real integrity, and other times they just disintegrate into something else. And there's that lovely march of the light through the dark, and the strange kind of balancing of light and dark in this piece. And then again, that really crazy, I love the fringe.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful.
It's like kinky hair, the warp hanging down.
And again, it feels like something from a tree. It feels like it could be hanging from a tree if it were hanging out of nature.
Spanish moss.
Yes, exactly. It's got the wonderful feeling you'd want to touch and feel. There's another very large piece which is a strong connection to poetry and a strong connection to Seamus Heaney, which I know you weren't able to bring for this exhibition, but it would be great to see it in Ireland.
Yeah, it's something I would love to see come here. It's a wall-sized tapestry of 5 meters long, based on the laments of the poet, the 16th century Polish poet Jan Kochanowski. And Seamus Heaney and Stanisław Barańczak translated these laments. They are poems written after the death of a child. And Falkowska, in 1965, made a tapestry of the text of these laments for the biennial in Lausanne, Switzerland. And it's now in the Museum of Textile Art in Łódź in Poland. And I've often thought that it's just a beautiful dialogue between one culture and another.
What has her work meant to you over these 3 decades now?
That's a tough question. I think I'm still trying to answer it. But one of the things that I think that this work always says to me is there's something happening here that is beyond the vagaries of the art world. It's art. And it's engaging in the world, and it's moving out in the world, and it's existing in galleries and museums, and it's being bought and sold. So it's part of the art world, but it's also beyond it and larger than it. And I think that more than anything, it's instructed me about that over the years. And even just knowing that Barbara is in her apartment in Warsaw, through Stalinism, through totalitarianism, through frenzied consumerism, and she's just continuing to make this work, not outside of it, not turning her back on the world, but with a larger picture in mind, and with her eye on nature in a very complex way.
Alice Lyons there at the Dock Art Centre in Carrick and Shannon. And Weaving the Sky, that retrospective exhibition of the work of Barbara Falkowska, runs until June the 7th. And I have to say, it'll be great to see her large-scale tapestry of the text of Kochanowski's poem, The Laments, on show somewhere here in Ireland. A deep link to the shared poetic landscapes of Poland and Ireland contained within that work. Let's hope we get to see the tapestry here. And indeed, a feeling of a shared Polish-Irish landscape in so much of Falkowska's work, the potency and yes, the beauty of the potato celebrated in one of her pieces, Kartoffel. That's it from us. You can listen back to previous programmes at rte.ie/radio1/artstonight. Back next Monday at 10. Till then, good night.
Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods, was produced by Aileen O'Mara for Digital Audio Productions.